Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg and talking with Kirk Gray in the ever-changing weather patterns of unpredictable weather in Colorado.
Right. Yes, as I said, it's at the end of March, and we may get snow again.
So. Well, you're going to get snow. It's not the end of March. It's the end of April. Come on.
April. April. I don't know when this thing will be broadcast. Podcast will
That's
be
true.
Out.
But, it'll probably be
end of April. You're right. And it's not unheard of. It'll be a wet snow real quick and it'll melt. But we were talking about some of the challenges in forecasting. And it's improved. But as far as my perspective from here, I've seen many missed forecasts in Colorado and in Texas, where it was mm-hmm. There wasn't any snow or precipitation when they had said there would be 70% chance or 60. Yeah. That depends on how far out they're from. The time from prediction to event is certainly a bigger factor.
Now, if that causes a problem for you, Kirk, or anything like that, you should move to California because we don't have weather. We have climate. We have climate.
You guys have weather reporters? Do they just say, yep, it's another beautiful day in the San Francisco Bay Area?
That's right. It's kind of boring, but you pay for it. Yeah. So, but that led to a quick discussion about the value of the math and modeling and all those things. And I know you and I have discussed that a number of times. Now, it reminded me, though, of an article I saw. I was doing some work for the CRE prep tutorials article series. And I ran across an article from the Harvard Business Review from the January-February issue in 1990, written by Taguchi and Claussen. And it was titled Robust Quality.
Yes.
And so I dug into that a little bit, and it lists a number of interesting features and principles and concepts and some of the basics of introducing this whole design philosophy. And and manufacturing process. And what basically the article was about was do continuous improvement, right? And by 1990, this was not a new concept in the quality world or in the world in general. But he was still writing about it and publishing about it and writing books about this basic notion that if you set a design and you get a tolerance around, say, a dimension within your design, it's not good enough if you make a product that's in spec versus making a product that's on target. And he goes on to talk about the Taguchi loss function, and he could quantify the further your product is manufactured away from the design target, the more it's going to cost you in warranty, lost sales, problems, and so on. And they used two case studies. I'm not sure if you've heard of, I didn't hear about one of them. One of them I had in college was Ford Motor Company. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it was transmissions. I don't remember.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It was basically exact same vehicle, same design, same transmission. And one was built in Japan, one was built in Detroit. And the Detroit ones were in spec. They went back mm-hmm. and remeasured a bunch of them. And there were some that were out of spec. There were some that are in. But a transmission that is just barely out of spec on some, you know, dimension of it versus one that's just barely in mm-hmm. is imperceptible to the driver. Except that in general, when it's near the edge of the specification, it's not as tight, it's not as good, it's not as efficient as one that's right dead center on the target.
Right.
And so the transmissions made in Japan, what even made it a study for anybody was that the transmissions made in the States had like four times the warranty expenses of the ones in Japan. Mm-hmm. And they said, what's going on here? What's different? And they found that it wasn't that the Japanese re-engineered the transmission or did anything different to the design, is that they invoked the continuous improvement. If it's supposed to be 3 millimeters, every single one that's made was made to be 3 millimeters, not mm-hmm. 3 millimeters plus or minus 10%.
Right.
If it was not on, there was work in the factory to improve the process, to
right.
fundamentally improve the process so that they would get on target more often.
Right.
The second case story was the Sony televisions. And I know you loved televisions.
Right.
And same thing. Sony created a factory in San Diego to make a television that they were also making in Japan. Same story. Mm-hmm. Dramatic in the fundamental difference between the two systems was Japan designed or built it to target, where San Diego factory designed to spec or built to spec.
Right.
And it shows up in dollars and cents later on. And
right.
So I we do this in reliability, right? We know that the design tolerancing and all those things allow us to manufacture products.
Yet right.
This notion of it's not that we want tight tolerances, is we want the end products to be without variability as much as possible,
right.
Be on target. And that improves the reliability. And that's why I'm writing about it. It's part of the body of knowledge for the Certified Reliability Engineering certification, mm-hmm. is this concept from Taguchi of continuous improvement and drive out variability and all those things.
Right, right.
But it's,
wasn't that a Deming concept too? Or
it is yeah. But his part was he agreed with continuous improvement. He certainly did, mm-hmm. and so did many of these other quality gurus right. over the decades. But he said that it was not the actually the article talks about that they built that Taguchi built on Deming's concept.
Okay. Where
Deming made the claim that 85% or see 15% of the problems with products are due to worker error, where they made a mistake, they didn't follow procedure, they screwed up, they put the wrong bolt in, and uh-huh. those kinds of things. 85% mm-hmm. of the problems stem from the process. That the process is, and you've heard of the red bead experiment.
Yeah, right. Where you did, where Deming would put in a few red beads into a mass of white beads and then ask the worker to pull out only white beads.
But it's completely random which ones you get. And
he'd
populate it enough that you'd almost always get a red bead. And then, right. he'd yell at you.
Right, for not doing it correct.
You not know, doing for, it correctly. You,
right.
You're not doing it right. And
when the system prevented that.
That's right. So Deming really stressed that the continuous improvement is not training. It's not make your workers smarter or make them follow the procedure better. Is
right.
change the procedure, change the equipment, change the system that you use to build it. The uh-huh. same applies to design. And this is where I'm going to tie it back to reliability. Now, you okay. and I know, and as many of our listeners know, is that, and it's also one of Taguchi's principles, is that you design in the quality, you design in the reliability.
Right.
In manufacturing, we can only make it worse, right?
Right.
That's all
you
we
build
can do.
In the margins. You build in the capability of robustness in the design.
That's right. And so a lot of our work as reliability engineers is influencing the design so that it's as reliable right from the start as it can be. And it
right.
needs to be able to accommodate the variability of the manufacturing process, storage and shipping and installation and of use.
Correct.
And so part of our job is to get it in the design to start with.
Right. And that's the problem there we have in general is that we have a spec and then we have to build in, or there has to be some capability beyond that spec, some margin of capability to be able to manufacture and allow for some variation, okay, although we want to reduce the variation as much as possible. We know, and especially in very high volume manufacturing, there's so many, there's second sources, there's so many opportunities for the second, third sources. It might be four suppliers for a certain connector or something like that. And as you've talked about, and I'm looking at the article in front of me, that and we'll put this in the show notes, link it for that Harvard Business Review, that, you know, we know there's going to be variation. We know that the end use environment is going to be very highly, especially what we were talking about previously, smartphones, is going to be extremely it's going to go to the extremes. People are going to break their phone because unreasonable levels of stress. So
we can say that with confidence.
Yeah, we can say that with confidence. In fact, any portable handheld device will eventually somebody will run over it with a car, will, you know, exceed any reasonable expectation of survival, mm-hmm, by anybody. But within that parameter of knowing that that's going to occur, making it as robust as possible not only protects that variation in the use environment, but will also allow some protection in the variation in manufacturing suppliers and different, you know, the different chains that will be made, different supplier chains that eventually come together to make a full product, you know.
All right. So what's our best way to do that, to get the design so it accounts for the variability that's going to come to it? And I think a corollary question for you, Kirk, is do we want a design for your daughter? Who's going to,
yeah, exactly. Right. But, you know, as we see this, we just talked about in our previous podcast about water resistance coming to phones. That wasn't to smartphones. That it was accepted previously that if you dropped your phone in the toilet or in the pool or in the bathtub, that you're very likely not to have a functioning phone in a few, mm-hmm, few days or immediately. So now that is being addressed with a better, more robust requirement for all smartphones. Apple was the first to do it, I think, with the iPhone 7, and now they've set a standard. They've raised the bar. So, mm-hmm, again, we know that eventually somebody will drop it in a lake and it will go down to 100 feet and, you know, not expect, and it's probably not going to survive, nor is somebody going to get it, but that will happen. Mm-hmm. And so.
Do you think they have a sensor on there this was at 12 feet of water, your warranty is void?
Exactly. Well, that was, you know, why one of my phones, when I went into the, one of the smartphone stores, said, look at this sensor, this little red dot, and it shows to us that you've submerged it in water, even though that wasn't the case, only a very quick water droplet had fallen on that connector opening, and that's why that sensor had turned red. I disagreed, and he hadn't opened the phone to see internally if there's any water damage or any indication. They had just put in a sensor. So now they're going to remove that, like, save some cost with that little sensor, which they were putting in at some cost to tell them that the consumer had damaged the phone. And
yeah, that's generally not good marketing in general.
No, I think, and in fact, there was another academic article that said that you could activate that indicator through just body sweat or other ways, exposure over a long period of time to, yeah, high humidity conditions. So
it speaks to, though, that, and I think part of it is the technology. We need the technology to catch up with the ability to seal, to manufacture, to transfer heat, to do all the things we need it to do so that it functions. And it's an ever-evolving piece of this. And I think it's one that we've talked about previously, is that the reliability requirements are reflected against the use conditions, the stresses that you expect to see the product in. Right. Now, there are some things that if you take a phone that's using CMOS technology and, mm-hmm, expose it to just put it in a blast furnace and keep it in there and expect it to transmit all the time, mm-hmm, we're going to melt the thing. The case, the solder, everything else is going to melt off.
Sure.
Now, there are electronics in blast furnaces, but completely different technology.
Sure.
Yet we're not willing to pay for that technology in a smartphone to get the marginal benefit that it'll survive.
Right.
A little bit.
That's part of the engineering trade-off.
Right. So there's going to be a bunch of that kind of stuff, and that's reasonable. There's two concepts that came out that struck me in this robust quality article that reflects the reliability gap. One is that we need to help the design teams understand the variability of manufacturing, the variability of the use conditions, such that we design to the appropriate level. So one thing we did at Hewlett-Packard is we knew we were making a printer that would go into homes. And the question is, well, what temperature, vibration, all these other stresses occur in homes. Mm-hmm. And so they did a huge study and instrumented up, I think, 1,000 printers and collected information. There were little data loggers, essentially, gathering all this stuff up. And we created distributions. And so we knew that the 90th percentile for temperature and humidity were these two values. And so the design team made a design decision to design to the 90th percentile for these different realms.
Okay.
Now, prior to that, they would have designed to, well, it's a home environment. It never gets hotter than 40 degrees C, so we'll design to that.
Right.
Or some other criteria.
Right.
So that gives us specs and tolerances.
Right. It's
only one part of it, right? The second part is that we need to build it with this concept of both the design process and the manufacturing process, where you're getting on target. You're building it, designing it to the right target, and you're building it to target, not to spec. And that's a cultural change, at least here in the U.S. And I don't know that that's gotten through to too many organizations yet.
Well, now, what if that printer, and I would imagine a lot of them, got onto in the back of a instrument van or, you know, some vehicle?
Oh, I saw I had a telephone repair guy. Yeah. He was hooking up our phone at this new house, and he said, let me get you a receipt and, stuff that he had to print out for me. And he had just a regular desktop printer on a piece of plywood with an inverter plugged into the cigarette lighter. And it worked perfect, but it would see a completely different vibration profile than a desktop.
And a temperature profile. It might be sitting out overnight here in Colorado.
That's right. That's right.
It'll get pretty cold.
Or hot, too.
Or hot in Phoenix, Arizona. You never know.
So
see, that's the thing. We make these assumptions. I mean, we have to come up with something, but there will be somebody using it to the extreme, or we'll push that capability, and not knowingly.
And that's where you and I tend to look at, well, let's figure out which set of stresses has the least margin, and then let's focus on those. If we know that we could take this printer and put it on a cobblestone street, high speed, low speed vibrations, so it's getting 20 G shocks repetitively, for all year, and there's so much margin, it just is no problem with that. We don't need to work on that. Where if it fails at 2 Gs, we're like, okay, well, this is a problem. We need to fix this.
Right, right.
I think these all tie together, though, is what we can do. And I think it's often overlooked, is what's the spread? What's the range of values? Not just absolute worst case. What's the range of values so that when we do halt testing, or when we do margining, or we do simulations and design work, we can identify the areas that are likely to cause us problems.
Right, right. And then after you identify those areas that would likely cause you problems, one thing that we always talked about when talking about applying HALT is trying to reach a fundamental limit of technology. Mm-hmm. And that is with standard materials and equipment, not using like special glues or sealants that would, would be special formulations or different materials other than just a plastic housing or something like that. But within that limit, you can actually have extremely robust systems with just standard materials. I mean, without using the 300 C melting solder, you can get you can have a circuit board operate to 130 C. you know, and not have to go extreme. In other words, it's not necessarily, there's not a direct correlation between the cost of a product and necessarily how much margin or strength it has in it, relative to what is relatively benign for most electronics is terrestrial conditions. Now, of course, in the oil well industry, they do have extremes that don't exist on the surface of the planet of 200 C down below, at, you know, 5,000 feet below the earth. And they do have to build, and they use special materials. They use special solders and component, maybe ceramic packages instead of a plastic encapsulated. But, you know, looking at these, some of these, and working with some of them, they use standard components, amazingly. I mean, 100 rated at 125, and they're using them at 175. So, you know, they validated that. But there's a lot of capability, and unless you test to those limits, you don't ever find what you really have already without, you know, saying we're going to design and, in fact, maybe put in more costs than necessary by making an assumption. But again, the progress, and you just talked about it a little bit, technology drives what we can do. For instance, previously with smartphones and most iPods and other portable devices, we had to have a plug-in socket for the headphone set. And by eliminating, by Apple in their iPhone 7 said, you know, we all have Bluetooth now. Bluetooth headsets and headphones are real common. And if we get rid of this one connector, we have one less place where moisture can come in. And, you know, it's caused a few complaints in the fact that it advanced technology that people still had their old favorite headsets that wanted, they wanted to plug in.
Well, you remember the hue and cry when they got rid of the CDs, the CD or DVD slots on their laptops.
Oh, yeah.
You know, how am I going to load software on this?
Exactly. And nowadays, you know, it's just like as we see the physical media as in decline. And, you know, if I could bet against DVDs for video and movies, and in fact, in the future, I think you and I could both predict it. It's not going to last forever. No. We've got so many other ways. And
well, vinyl records are coming back, though. Don't never say never.
I know. That's a silly one.
Let's wrap it up here, though. So you're going to add the link to the article. This is the Harvard Business Review article from the January-February 1990, and it's titled Robust Quality. It's an oldie but goodie. It's titled Robust Quality. So as a reliability person, keep in mind that we do everything the quality folks do. We just have to do it longer.
Right.
That's the way I think of it.
We add time to that factor.
We add time to it. It's not just once and you're good. It's over time. And so the basic premises of the article are really aimed at quality in general as the terms in this concept of continuous improvement.
Right.
They certainly apply to the reliability field. And so hopefully gave you a little bit of something to think about. So take a look at the article. Mm-hmm. Or as a listener, you know, other stuff that you've seen in this continuous improvement part. And think about how do you use these concepts to improve the reliability of the products and systems you're working on? And if you got some insights or notes that we didn't get to in this episode, let us know. Head over to reliability.fm. And there's a number of comment fields and feedback forms and areas you can get in touch with us. Let us know. What do you think? What did we miss that these basic quality concepts and philosophies and how to apply them in a reliability field? Love to hear from you. So with that, Kirk, you got your snow shovel ready, or you think you're going to need snow blower today?
Fortunately, it'll be a wet snow and it won't stick around long. Probably won't even gather on the street. So we'll have an easy snow. These are nice. They just look pretty, but cause no traffic issues generally. So yeah, we're looking forward to springtime and summer coming soon, and it's already actually been here.
Earlier this morning. Yeah, it's summertime.
So yeah, we're looking forward to it, and we'll post this article, and I look at it here now, and it's very, very relevant to what we're doing today. So we'll put that in the show notes, and everybody get a chance to read it.
That'd be great. Well, thanks so much, Kirk, and we'll talk
Thank
to you,
you Fred. Okay, take care.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.